CJRS/5th Annual Fundrise, a celebration of our 20 years of shared awesomeness. As an awesome listener to your community radio station, you can expect a full week of heartfelt content. Be ready to donate to our campaign and let's be awesome together. Fundrise runs October 30th to November 5th. Donating to CJSF 90.1 FM's Fundrive is awesome, and so are you, which is why we think you're a perfect match for each other. Keep being awesome and donate now at cjsf.ca/donate to support your awesome community radio station, CJSF 90.1 FM.
Real food, real farming, for me, is the biggest climate solution. Fake food as a climate solution is a fake solution. Food is about eating. Food is about nourishment. And if it's nutritionally empty food, you're going to get all kinds of sicknesses and disease. And in this world of vibrant life, rich diversity, and deep intelligence, practicing real farming, eating real food, in my view, becomes the revolutionary act.
That's Vandana Shiva. And this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamyan. This edition of AR features Vandana Shiva on real food, real farming. We live in a time where our connection with food and with the farmers that grow it has been undermined. The root of the problem is a growing dependence on a dysfunctional paradigm based on pesticides and monocultures, and a separation between humans and nature. How we produce, distribute, and consume food is increasingly becoming the center of the multiple crises we face today. Ecologist Vandana Shiva says, "It is possible and healthy to have a whole and nutritious diet based on biodiverse plants. But," she warns, "do not become subscribers to Bill Gates' fake food empire. We must," she urges, "join hands with the earth and return to a culture of care that provides dignity to farmers who produce real food to feed the world." Our guest today is Vandana Shiva, an internationally renowned voice for sustainable development and social justice. She's founder of Navdanya and director of the Research Foundation for Science, Technology, and Natural Resource Policy in New Delhi. She's the author of many books. Her latest is Terra Viva. She spoke in Sweden in early 2023. And now, Vandana Shiva.
And thank you to all of you. So when they asked me for a title for the public talk, I said, real food, real farming. Because so much of the aggression in our times, every newspaper, every TV show, is talking about saving the world with fake food. Just like half a century ago, they brought fake fertilizers, synthetic fertilizers, and said we won't be able to feed the world without fake fertilizers. And they were synthesized nitrogen by fixing atmospheric nitrogen through burning fossil fuels. Then they said we won't save the world without having GMOs. And now they're saying we won't save the world without you eating fake food. Now, A, if there wasn't a history of the consequences of fake narratives, on the one hand, and on the other hand, so much thinking in science, in practice, of what food is. This exercise of fakeness, of saying those people who are financing this, because, you know, no one shifts to fake food on their own. No one shifts to GMOs on their own. These are always forced. So fake food will have to be forced. And the worldview that's being created is farming without farmers. Food without farms. Of course, farming is what farmers do. And till recently, half of humanity anyway, I think more than half of humanity even today does agriculture, especially if you go to the south. In India, they've been trying to force the farmers off the land ever since globalization, the Green Revolution. And yet 60% of Indians still are rural and live on the land, are farmers. are dependent on the land. So this farming without farmers and food without farms basically is food from labs. But food from labs doesn't come out of thin air. It still needs feedstock. And from the experience we have had, each escalation of the artificial is an escalation of external inputs. You use more resources, you use more energy to produce worse outputs. So, you know, India has had deep thinking. I mean, when I was busy doing quantum theory, I wasn't reading all this amazing stuff. But when the food question became urgent to me after 1984, when the Green Revolution in Punjab had led to so much destruction that the farmers rose in revolt. 15,000 people were killed in the what happened after that. And then the Golden Temple had to be invaded, which is a sacred shrine of the Sikhs. And that same year, a pesticide plant of Union Carbide leaked in the city of Bhopal, killed thousands. The gas just went through in the middle of the night, winter night, killing, and people are still dying. And 10 of my sisters have gone on a hunger strike to say, when will you give justice to Bhopal? This is 1984. We are in 2023. Next year will be 40 years. So these two things shook me up, and I wanted to understand. So I studied the Green Revolution. And then I started to follow ecological farming, in which there's so many schools. I think the deepest thinking is in the biodynamic. The most organized practices are in the organic, because it's got eForm, it's got standards, it's got certification. It had Albert Howard. Albert Howard was sent to India by the British in 1905 to improve Indian agriculture, because that's what the colonizers had to do, to always improve us. And he arrived, but he was a good scientist. And he could see with his eyes, these soils are so fertile. I cannot teach the peasants how to improve their practices. And he found the fields were full of insects, but there was no pest damage. So he said, I'm going to make the pest and the peasant my professor to learn good farming. As a result of which, he wrote the book, The Agricultural Testament, which is what basically guides the organic movement. But we've been eating. Every being eats. To be alive means to eat. And when I started to investigate deeper more recently, I did a whole book on food and health and its links. I went back to writings of people who were looking much more at the spiritual values of food, at the ecological values of food. And I just want to open by sharing with some quotes. So I've come to the conclusion that the web of life is a food web, that food is a flow, it's a currency. Food is not stuff. Food is not a thing. Food is definitely not junk. And food is not a commodity. So the web of life is a food web. And the cycle of life is a food cycle called the nutrition cycle. Everyone knows the nutrition cycle is vital. It's a food cycle. And this is regenerative agriculture. Anna is food. A-N-N-A is a word for food in Hindi, in Sanskrit. It says, for it is of Anna that indeed all beings are born. And it is from Anna that they obtain the necessary sustenance for living. And having lived, it is into Anna they emerge at the end. And that's the soil. And the best is, everything is food. Every being is made of food. Every being is someone else's food. Immediately, we realize we are part of the web of life. We are members of an earth family. And this, 300-400 years of craziness, of thinking we are top of the pyramid. Other beings are below us. They're just objects to be manipulated, objects to be exterminated and pushed to extinction. That thinking is actually not that old. That mechanical thinking began with Mr. Descartes and Mr. Bacon. And they were given the job of creating sciences of conquest. Bacon was the Chancellor of England. And in the time when he was the Chancellor, he was also in charge of the Inquisition, the witch hunts. So he took that whole interrogating the witches into a scientific method and said, it's torture of nature that allows us to know her secrets. You've got to subjugate nature. You've got to make her your slave. And so we have a very violent way of thinking in a mechanistic way and a reductionist way. Of course, the irony, you know, I think often how, you know, this level of arrogance then finds its answers. So Mr. Bacon died by stuffing snow into a chicken to see if he could preserve the chicken by filling it with snow. Mr. Bacon got influenza and he died, the chicken didn't. It's a very brutal experimental method, you know, a brute empiricism. And the gentle empiricism that Goethe talked about and other scientists who really see the whole and see all the relationships. And I love this one. So do not look, since food sustains life, it says, do not look down upon Anna. That is the inviolable discipline of the one who knows prana, you know, the breath and life. In the Mahabharata, they say that the highest dharma is the right action. And the highest dharma is the growing and giving of good food. And that's why India had this amazing tradition. You come to someone's house, they feed you because they're dharma. For the farmer, the dharma was not doing an agriculture of carelessness. I've worked with all kinds of communities in India, and I remember a particular time I was helping an indigenous community who was fighting a bauxite mine on their sacred mountain, Yamgiri. So I'd gone there to support them, and I was having meetings with them, and at a certain point, one of the members just got up and mumbled something and left. And you know, your typical understanding is, oh, something must have happened. It must be an emergency. What he was mumbling, and his colleagues told me, so he was saying, now I must go beautify the earth. Farming is beautifying the earth. Farming in a good way, in a non-violent way. So the growing of giving of food is the highest dharma. Not growing food, or growing food badly, or giving people bad food is the highest adharma, the opposite. So we've, of course, messed up with the food system. First, it began with making fake fertilizers because soil fertility is the living process of a living soil. Soil is living, and the life in the soil creates the soil fertility. You know, this planet was a dead planet. But we are a living planet because first the microbes, then the plants, through photosynthesis, could take the sunlight and transform it and absorb the carbon dioxide. We were a carbon dioxide-rich planet and depleted in oxygen. 98% CO2. And just this photosynthesis process of the green leaf and microbes took the sunlight, took the CO2, turned it into carbohydrates that many are now calling the molecule of life. And at the same time, give us breath, give us oxygen. No mechanical system can do all this, none. But those carbohydrates the plant produces are then food for the microbes that turn minerals into soil. From the minerals, they bring the nutrients to the plant, they get the energy from the carbohydrates, and then the plant's organic matter is recycled. And before you know it, you're creating soil as a living system by co-creating with living systems. And this then created the conditions where our species could arrive. The oxygen increased, the carbon dioxide decreased, the temperatures, which used to be, how much was it? The temperatures came down to a livable temperature for the human species to evolve. But this is also where we should be looking, how, you know, the whole, what's the Gaia hypothesis? The Gaia hypothesis is the Earth is living, her living biosphere creates the atmosphere and regulates the atmosphere. And that's the reason temperatures came down, carbon dioxide came down. But what are we doing today? Industrial agriculture is a destruction of the biosphere and biodiversity, and the illusion that somehow fossil fuels will replace it. Because all synthetic fertilizers, you know, they're fossil fuel based, the nitrogen fertilizers, 1 kilogram of fertilizer uses 2 liters of diesel, and then it emits nitrous oxide. 90% is wasted, goes into the waters. And the soil organisms cannot live with the salt. So you have desertification. And these externalities, of course, once seen. You know, when I did the book on the Green Revolution, on the one hand, a lot of people, you know, started to see these connections. And on the other hand, those who had pushed the Green Revolution started to panic because the narrative was, we feed the world with chemicals. And here in Punjab, the chemicals were ruining the land, killing the water. Our work has shown that, you know, the synthetic fertilizer use then weakens the plant. You use 10 times more water. The plant is just water. Absolute feast for pests. You get more pest attacks, so you use more pesticides. Fertilizer use leads to pesticide use. And there's a cancer tree that leaves Punjab called the cancer tree. Its name is the cancer tree because of the heavy pesticide use. And yet, we're still being told, you know, that they keep organizing in a new way. And right now, the way the pesticide industry has organized itself is called the crop life. It has nothing to do with crops and has nothing to do with life. It's basically companies that produce toxic chemicals to kill insects, to kill plants, and human beings. Bhopal was human beings being killed by pesticides. 200,000 farmers die every year because of pesticide poisoning. So this is not a science of life. They re-engineered their name from the agrochemical industry to the life sciences industry when they were starting to use GMOs or wanting to use GMOs. And that's the second attempt of creating, of basically find ways to manipulate and substitute nature and substitute good farming by creating an unnecessary input. If synthetic fertilizers were the first unnecessary input, manipulating seeds and plants to make GMOs in order to take patents was the second. And, you know, when people ask me, why are you against GMOs? I said, I'm not against GMOs, but I'm against blindly accepting something that has totally failed. As a scientist, a failed tool cannot constantly be retooled as a miracle. Mr. Gates has recently said the GMOs are miracle seeds, magic seeds that are feeding the world. When this whole debate started in the 90s, and I would debate the World Bank, I would debate the industry, and they would say, yeah, the Green Revolution, things went wrong, but now we have the perfect technology. We're going to grow food on the moon, in the Sahara, and on toxic dumps. What did we get now, 30 years later? All we have is BT toxin crops and herbicide-resistant Roundup Ready crops. That's it, 2 traits. In 4 crops, corn, canola, soya, cotton. I know what the BT cotton did to my country because I was forced to go into cotton, saving seeds, training organic farmers, helping create economies of weaving and using that organic cotton. Since globalization, we've lost 400,000 farmers to suicide because of debt. of these, because this is the government data and the government puts out in this district, in this state, this many, we know that the districts and states where the cotton is grown. Because stock cotton doesn't grow everywhere. 85% of the 400,000 are in the cotton area. And our competition commission recognized 3 years ago, I think before Bayer took over Monsanto, they had recognized that Monsanto had a monopoly on cotton. 95, according to the government data, 95% cotton seed in India, and I guess the world, is GMO BT cotton. Now, if you produce a BT toxin plant to control pests, the success of that technology is the pests get controlled. The failure of that technology is you have more pests, and the pest you were trying to control is now resistant, so you've created a super pest. A pest control technology that creates super pests is not effective. In the US, it was mainly Roundup Ready crops to spray more glyphosate, to kill all plants, you know, as the Monsanto. I remember during the negotiations of Convention on Biological Diversity, a Monsanto representative got up and said, "We have such a smart technology that we can prevent the weeds from stealing the sunshine." And for them, then killing all biodiversity, except the four plants that they were using, was basically a contribution. I think this is a very clear example of creating a product to kill life on Earth, the green leaf that is the basis of the whole cycle of food. Today, half the farmlands of the United States are overtaken by superweeds created by Roundup Ready crops. Because what was ignored was that plants are intelligent, bacteria are intelligent, and when an insect is intelligent, and this constant pressure leads intelligent organisms to evolve resistance. So you have super-resistant weeds and you have super-resistant pests and more toxics are being sprayed, and that's why they're rushing for gene editing, which the European Court of Justice has recognized as a GMO, because a GMO is a genetically modified organism where modification is done at the genetic level. Whether you add a new gene or you edit a gene, the results in both are genetic modification. And because all living systems, including the seed and the plant, are systems which are self-organized complexity, autopoiesis, as Vacharana and Varela has said, and self-organization means an amazing harmony at every level of the genome. Every element of the genome is linked to other elements of the genome. One gene, one trait is not true. All genes work together to produce one trait. And each gene contributes to multiple traits because it's not a linear one-to-one relationship. And they're now calling gene editing as precision breeding. There's nothing about breeding there. And it's definitely not precision. Because when you're dealing with complexity, you don't look for precision. You look for balance. You look for non-violence. And already in the first year, and another interesting thing is, when molecular biology was created, the Rockefellers were funding the whole gene reductionism. You know, we want to find genes under the skin because they had been, you know, eugenics had been criticized for sexism, for racism. So they said, okay, we'll put all this atoms of determinism, they called it, under the skin. And they funded molecular biology to reduce complexity of life to the molecules of determination. And that's why the ideology of genetic determinism is the gene is a master molecule. There's no master in life. Everything is a network. And all through those years, every Nobel Prize was given to people Rockefeller had funded. More recently, what happened? Mr. Gates funded gene editing, the CRISPR-Cas9 technology. And it's interesting, you know, CRISPR is that technology of absorbing a virus is the way bacteria deal with viruses. So they just saw how nature works and then appropriated it as their invention. And he funded the California scientists and the scientists in Cambridge. Then they started to fight. So he funded both to fight the patent. And he has a company called Editas that holds gene editing patents. But he got the Berkeley scientists the Nobel Prize. And this at a time when other scientists were finding out that it's such an imprecise and disrupting technology. Just give you one or two examples. You know, it talks about precision, but a study found that 1,500 single nucleotide mutations took place and 100 larger deletions and insertions when one gene was edited. One gene. 1,500 unpredictable impacts. An increasing body of knowledge is showing there is total unpredictability in the outcome. I remember very clearly, in India we love the horns of cow, and biodynamic agriculture is so based on the cow horns. And we have festivals. We have the festival of the animals. And they decorate the horns of the cows, and the cows are left free. You can't rope them in. They won't work. They're on a holiday. And they go around with these beautiful, they're all over the place, these beautifully decorated animals. And when you take animals and put them in a factory farm, those horns become a problem. You know, they start fighting each other, just like the pig's tail becomes a problem in factory condition, and the beak of the chicken becomes a problem. So they de-beak, they burn the newborn chickens, so they won't fight each other. They detail the pigs. So they create conditions of violence and then do more violence to solve the problem, which can't be solved. Anyway, gene editing, some scientists in California said, we will now gene edit a bull, we'll gene edit animals to be hornless for the meat industry, to have more bigger factory farms. But from somewhere in these gene edited animals, there was huge bacterial infection. And you cannot sell bacteria-infected meat. So I remember this debate because they tried to get permission to sell it as for beef. And they were not allowed. So the imprecision is so known. And yet the desperation is so huge. Because why is gene editing being pushed? Gene editing is being pushed because not only can they not work with the old GMOs anymore, they're trying very hard to pretend their nature. They're trying to pass it as a natural technology so that they can deregulate for biosafety and get out of labeling. So once they get gene editing through as natural, it will not require safety. So there'll be all this stuff happening in your food and you won't know it. And you won't be able to make the choice that I don't want to eat this stuff because it will have a label natural. Yeah. So we are at a very dishonest moment, extremely dishonest moment in terms of our food. And this, because movements have been so successful, because the agro-organic movement has been so successful, because the biodynamic movement has been so successful, this is why the aggression to introduce fake technologies and force it on society has become the single most biggest agenda for the industry. And when I say industry, I mean both the financial part of it and the biotech part of it, the part that wants to control the seed and now to control the food. So synthetic fertilizers began with began the introduction of synthetic elements, artificial elements into the food system. Then you had, instead of breeding of whole organisms with whole organisms, you now had genetic engineering to really not have the clearance of the organism to accept modification. It was a forcing of the organism. And in the process, you actually created fake seed. Why do I call it fake seed? Because the nature of seed is to arise. The word in India for seed is bija. Ja is life, bija is that which arises on its own forever and ever and ever. Because the seed doesn't ever get exhausted.